Lean Leadership Podcast, episode 62.
This is the Lean Leadership Podcast. Equip yourself with the tools for success in your team's lean journey by learning from the world's top lean professionals. Listen at the risk of improving with your host, Chris Burnham.
Today's guest is Jamie Flinchbaugh. Jamie was the second guest on the Lean Leadership Podcast. You probably know Jamie from The Hitchhiker's Guide to Lean or some of the other publications that he has written in from time to time. He is also the co-host of the Lean Whiskey Podcast with Mark Raven. Jamie has helped purpose-driven leaders craft effective, resilient organizations at over 300 companies, leveraging more than 30 years of experience and helping build over 20 different companies. Jamie has helped leaders across a wide spectrum of industries, including healthcare, utilities, technology, consumer products, and professional services. Some of the names of the companies include Harley-Davidson, Intel, Mars, Amazon, Crayola, Fidelity, Whirlpool, among many others. Jamie is the type of person in our industry who exhibits great lean principles and the type of leadership that I try to emulate in my work every day. He is someone who has offered valuable advice to me often in my lean journey. And if you'd like to hear Jamie's story about his lean journey, his setbacks, and successes, you can check out episode 2 of the podcast. Today, we're going to talk about Jamie's soon-to-be-released book, People Solve Problems, The Power of Every Person, Every Day, Every Problem. Jamie was generous enough to share with me an advanced copy of the book, and today we talk about the book, the process around why he wrote this book, and some of the lessons and reflections from authoring his second book. I think when you hear our conversation, you'll understand that this just isn't another book about lean. Here's our guest,
Jamie Flinchbaugh. It's great to see you. For folks that are familiar with Jamie Flinchbaugh on this podcast, you can go back and listen to his episode 2. He was the second person I interviewed here. And hear Jamie's lean story, his setbacks, his successes. But today we're really here to talk about People Solve Problems, Jamie's new book. Jamie, it's great to see you. How are you?
I'm doing great. Glad to be here. I remember when you reached out and we did episode 2. It was quite a while ago, and look where we both are today. So,
well, I'm excited about this book. I'm excited about sharing this with everyone. For folks that may not be familiar with your work, can you tell them a little bit about yourself and a little bit about what you do in your company?
Yeah, so I mean, I've been working on lean for 30 years now, a bunch of time inside of companies early on at Harley and Chrysler and DT Energy. I ran a consulting firm that I co-founded with Andy Carlino and Dennis Pauly for 15 years. We worked with over 300 companies around the world. After selling that, I spent time in the executive team at Qorvo Semiconductor, helping transform that company with a great group of people there. And then beginning of 2020, I started an advisory firm, Jay Flinch, which is, you know, really pretty much just me. But I basically act as a coach and advisor to mostly internal thought leaders that are trying to help help transform their company, that have the audacity to lead and want to go create great stuff.
Great. Jamie, I know that you put a lot of great content out on LinkedIn. Your videos are great. I really appreciate them. I love the 1 minute touch points. Great way to digest and get a lot of knowledge from that standpoint. But what led you to write People Solve Problems?
Well, it probably stems from a couple of things. One is that way back when everybody said, what's the definition of lean? Well, it's about waste elimination. Like I always felt that was a poor definition. And I've said for quite a while, I think it's more about problem solving than it is about waste elimination. So that's, I've always been curious about that. Then on top of it, when I go look at problem solving in organizations, like I wouldn't even give people templates because I'd go look at the best 5 companies and they all use different templates, and the worst 5 companies and they use the same templates as the good ones, right? So it's like, there's more to it than that. And so that got me curious about really sort of unraveling that. And then, you know, in addition to starting a new firm in 2020, I always love writing. I've written columns for many years. It's been a long, long time since my first book, Hitchhiker's Guide to Lean. But fundamentally, writing clarifies my thinking. it helps, you know, even if I just put these out as blog posts or just put them away, it's already made me a better coach and advisor because it helps me be clear about my thinking. And then I'm going to say the last thing, and this was the same rule I put in place when we wrote the Hitchhiker's Guide, which is the stuff I wrote about in here isn't written about much, right? So I didn't want to just write another book just like, oh, here's Jamie's take on things everybody else has said. Let me write about it this in a way that people aren't writing about it and hopefully make something additive to the world. So that was part of my goal in writing this.
I appreciate that. It came through in the book when I read it in the advanced copy. And you and I had talked a while back when you told me about this project that you were taking on. You fundamentally approached how you wrote the book differently. You didn't write using the same process that you wrote with The Hitchhiker's Guide to Lean. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, well, I'll start it off with some brainstorming. And I knew I was, again, 2020, I was going to head towards writing a book anyway. When we were all sort of stuck at home early on, I grabbed some Post-its and I have a sort of wall of windows, a couple of doors on my office. And I just started brainstorming and categorizing and then I would go up to the Poconos to write the mountains in Pennsylvania because I don't write well in the same place I work. So when I wrote The Hitchhiker's Guide, interestingly, I wrote most of it at a Starbucks because at the time, Starbucks didn't have Wi-Fi. So I could go there and be left alone and just be one with a keyboard. So I'd go away from my office. I'd borrow my in-law's cottage in the mountains, just me in the mountains writing. And, you know, I wrote a first draft. Actually, if you go look at the outline, the book only includes about a third of my original outline, because once I started writing, I realized, boy, this is going to be like a 600-page, you know, epic tome if I include all of these topics. So then I started, you know, culling stuff, and I worked with some others. In particular, Rob Wirth helped me rethink the structure of the book. And so it took about five trips to the up to the mountains till I really had, I'll say, my second draft, which is from there it was editing. I'd say a first draft and then a full rewrite, second draft, and then I'll say it was editing from there.
Well, what I love about it is that when it comes to people solving problems, sometimes you have to approach the problem differently. And so the seed of this book is you approached how you wrote the book differently, just from a traditional idea. I also love the thought of not writing in the space that you work. So that forces you into a mode of reflection versus being in the always on mode or hyper attentive mode to the work environment. So it shows through in the book. I appreciate you sharing the process with us. I'm going to dive right into the book and just kind of ask a couple questions that, you know, that jumped out to me. I promise I'm not going to give away the entire plot to the book because we want people to go learn and discover on their own. But one of the analogies that you gave in the book that stood out to me was about, say, if I were given Yo-Yo Ma's cello or Wynton Marsalis's trumpet, and I gave them a kazoo, who would make better music? And you were using that to highlight the difference between tools and skills and training. And while this analogy seems like it doesn't just apply to problem solving, it kind of applies to leadership in general. Can you kind of expand on how you arrived at that visual for what you're trying to communicate?
Well, so part of it, in addition to being a Wynton Marsalis fan and a jazz fan, I've seen Yo-Yo Ma in concert, and I was actually behind him by about 5 yards, maybe. And I could see his hand. I could see every little muscle in his hand move as he played. It was just an incredible experience. And also at one point, I just for my own amusement, I bought everyone in our family a kazoo just to see who was going to be most annoyed and who was going to be most annoying. Right. But so that's where some of those specifics came out. But we've all seen this, right? You see people use a problem solving template And they put it in front of you, and people would bring me finished, and I always hate this, finished A3s all the time. I'm like, what do you want me to do with this? And they're just looking for approval of their finished work. But I look at it, I'm like, no, everything on this is wrong. I don't even know where to start. It's so badly done. And it's fine. It's not their fault. I mean, nobody's, you know, people train them how to, what goes in what block on the template, but they didn't even approach it with the right mindset. They didn't approach it with the right capability. And sometimes we just had to start over. And so I've seen that so many times where it's like the template, I mean, they took the training, right? It wasn't how to use the tool. It was how to approach using the tool, how to think about it, what to bring to it. It was really everything that happens off the page that was limiting the person's ability to be successful, not what was happening on the page.
I can remember as a very much younger lean learner, being able to go to Pascal Dennis's course on A3s they put on for LEI. And the emphasis was on getting up and telling the story. It was, did you feel comfortable with your thought process that you put on paper that you could convey that information? And, I remember one of the students in the class saying, well, how would I know that, when he challenged him? He goes, oh, you go for a walk. You go and discover. He goes, and then you iterate this. That's why there's a version block down in the back. There is never a finished product. There's always the current version of what we've discovered on this, because every time you go for a walk, you learn something new, which then reinforms your current state, which then forces you to examine things. So I think that skill that he wasn't teaching us how to fill out a form that weekend. It was completely about, do you understand how to tell a story, and do you understand how to use this as a way to convey storytelling for lean and continuous improvement?
Yeah. And I think lean is, it's not just problem solving, right? I hone in on problem solving because I think it's ubiquitous at every organization, every level in the organization. It's what we do. But go back to the 90s, I think the right time frame of the book Learning to See, and value stream mapping became very popular, right? So I remember sitting down with Mike Rother. I think we just met for coffee one day, and we were talking about the book, and we were talking about people's efforts at value stream mapping. And what I observed was, in the book was like eight questions, like ask these, I forget if it was eight or nine, but ask these eight questions. And the book didn't say this, but people treated it like out pops the magic answer. And of course that wasn't true. And I was sharing my observation with Mike, and Mike was having a very different experience. And that's because when Mike was in the room, they didn't use the eight questions like a recipe. It was simply just things to ask, but it was the dialogue. It was the thought process. It was the curiosity. It was the ideal state thinking that really drove the conversation. It's not, there's only so much a book can do. It's not the book's fault that it didn't make that clear, that it's more than the eight questions, right? But you would see people, I think this is what made, Mike so curious about things like Kata, there's more to it than that. It was what you brought to the conversation that really made the difference, not following the eight questions. Again, the eight questions are useful, but they're not a recipe, and the magic answer doesn't pop out the end.
I'm glad you brought up recipe, because that's actually one of the things that I thought about when you were talking about this, about understanding the skills that go behind with people solving problems, is that you can't go out and experience cookbook lean. Like, you can't just follow a recipe and get this out. The same way in your kitchen, you can't just mishmash a few things together and hope to get the end result. Like, you need to understand that this is how we mix the butter. This is how we measure properly. This is the order in which we mix the ingredients, because if you mix them in any other way, you may get a different outcome. This is why you have to prepare the oven and have the oven at the right temperature before you put the ingredients in. Yes, you can follow the same amount of time, but as any of us who have traveled or lived in different parts of the world with different elevations, we all understand that 30 minutes at 350 degrees is very different in Memphis, Tennessee than it is up in Denver, Colorado. Like you have to adjust for that. And it comes with knowledge and experience and someone teaching you along the way. You don't just follow the instructions and out pops a delicious cake.
Yeah. And at the risk of overextending your analogy of cooking, right, is I think cooking and baking, you know, baking is often very precise, right? And there is a right way to do it and there's a wrong way to do it. But cooking, right, if you want to make a stew or, you know, there's a bunch of right ways to do it. There's wrong ways too, right? But depending on what you do have in your kitchen, if you know what you're doing, you can substitute one thing for another. You can play with different pathways to produce a good product. And I think with lean journeys and problem solving excellence, there are more than one way to get there. There's ways to get it wrong. But it's not like baking where there's, you know, you need precision and you need one right way. There's multiple ways to get there. And that's where I, even with problem solving templates, I love it when people build their own, because it's like, oh, let me figure out my way, right? Even if it's not better, there's a sense of ownership over it and a sense of creation that I think makes people smarter about why they're doing it the way they are.
Well, and you talked about that in the book, that when you open up creativity to people, typically what they come up with isn't that far off from the other templates that are out there in the world for what they're coming up with. Every now and then there's a eureka moment where something is radically different. But for the most part, on a normal distribution, on a process, you're going to fall within the curve from where they are. That's the great. We could go on. We could do an entire podcast on just that subject. So I want to make sure we move on. But Jamie, why is it so hard for people to create great problem statements? Because you talked a little bit about that in the book, about getting your problem statement right.
Yeah, and it's important because it sets the tone for everything you do after. Right. If you do that poorly, you're going to do a whole bunch of work and be misguided, right? Be headed off in the wrong path. I think the number one reason, or maybe the first reason, that people struggle with it is they just kind of go in assuming it's easier than they thought. They just assume, hey, I see a problem here. Doesn't everyone else see the problem here? And they assume they see it in the same way, right? So I remember as a project that we started at one organization where it took like a year and a half just to get started, and it was super complex. But the main reason was that everybody agreed that something was wrong. No two people agreed on what that was, and so you really needed to spend time socializing it because getting some alignment around what the gap was, because everyone saw it a different way. So everyone experienced it a different way. I think the other thing that really hampers people is they sort of enter problem statements with a sense of finality. Like, okay, we got to get this right. So even if they're like, okay, let me get past the idea that I assume everybody sees it the same way. Now I actually get that it's hard, but I spend my time trying to perfect it. And I spend my time trying to get it right instead of like, okay, here's what we have now. Let's treat this in pencil. Let's treat this as with hold it lightly and be curious about the problem statement changing based on what we learn. And I don't have empirical data on this. This is simply my experience. But I get that when I'm involved in coaching problem solving, it's not like everyday problems. It's not like the nuts and bolts kind of stuff. They're complex problems usually. But I'd have to say that at least 50% of the time, and probably more like 80% of the time, we change the problem statement after we start, because we get into things, we uncover some things, we have some aha moments, we have some lessons learned, we might get some more feedback, and we kind of go, yeah, our problem statement's wrong, which is why I love the question of just, okay, as we come back together, what is the problem statement and is it still the right problem statement?
Yeah. It's
a nice key gateway question to keep asking ourselves as we go forward.
Well, I think part of that is for folks that haven't had a lot of experience with creating great problem statements, oftentimes we think we know what the solution is. So we try to create it's almost like we're playing Jeopardy, where we're trying to form our problem statement in the form of a question that gives us the answer that we want. Whereas a really well-crafted problem statement is based on this spirit of discovery of I believe this is what's happening. I want to go test this hypothesis to see. And for me personally, in my career, the teams that I've worked with, it's more fun when you realize you've been asking the wrong question or you've been chasing the wrong thing. Like, oh, wait, that's not it. Like, this is what we're looking to understand.
Yeah. And I'll say basic problem solving training will usually cover the idea of not including your solution in the problem statement, but it's so easy to do so unintentionally, right? Because we see what we want, we see where we want to end up, and we, you know, sort of, you know, Wayne Gretzky, skate to where the puck is going to be. So we craft the problem statement in a way that closes certain doors and keeps the one open that we want. And some, you know, you'll see some people do this with very deliberate attempts. I'm just trying to, you know, manipulate those around me to get what I want. So we're going to weaponize problem solving. And others, it's just, you know, our desire is getting the best of us. And we come blind to the fact that we've closed the wrong doors in shaping that problem statement. So not that I want it to be, you know, so open-ended that anything's possible. Again, you're trying to frame the box in which you're going to go explore. So boundary conditions are really healthy as you go into it. But it's very easy to unintentionally close some doors that we might actually want to walk through at some point.
Great discussion on problem statements. Shifting our mind just a little bit, wearing that coach's hat, and you talked about coaching and the importance of coaching, and I don't want to deep dive on that in a little bit, but in general, as someone who is genuinely desiring to become a better problem solver, other than picking up the book and reading it, like, what's some advice that you would give to folks who don't necessarily have a lot of confidence in their ability to solve problems or recognize a gap that there's an ability to improve their problem solving skills?
So, you know, you already mentioned coaching, and I think that's perhaps, you know, the number one lever, which is why I did commit so much time to it. But I think deliberate practice, right? So Mark, I contributed to Mark Graben's book, Practicing Lean, and there's a lot of purpose behind the selection of that title. And in Practicing Lean, is that, you know, we never really master it. We just keep practicing it and we get better each time as long as the practice is deliberate. And so deliberate practice has to include some form of reflection, even if it's just self-awareness. I like to say now retired soccer coach, practice doesn't, when my players would be practicing sloppy at practice, I'd say practice doesn't make perfect, practice makes permanent. So if you practice sloppy, you're going to play sloppy. Well, practice problem solving deliberately with good intent, with observing yourself as a problem solver. And reflect on it, right? Whether you sit down and reflect on it or grade yourself or simply just, you know, become aware of when you're on autopilot and when you're really engaging your brain in the right way. And I think the other thing is do problem solving collaboratively with as many other people as possible. I'm not saying for each problem, like, you know, we have a team of 40, so that, you know, but problem solve collaboratively with this person and with that person and this with third person. And then you'll learn from others as well. They'll point out blind spots, maybe not intentionally, but just ask by the questions they ask or the steps they want to take. And you know, I like to say, you know, problem solving is not just a team sport, it's a contact sport. And I think we get better when we do it with an open mind with others. And that makes us develop our skill and our capability and our mindfulness in our problem solving.
And that actually leads perfectly into my next question, which is the need for creative tension. Problem solving doesn't always mean gaining agreement. You have to have that tension in order to gain consensus. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah. So tension is interesting, and I think it's particularly relevant right now. And when I say right now, I mean in the world we live in, where almost every organization is suffering from staffing shortages and supply chain challenges, and all the other things going on in the world. I mean, I checked into my hotel a couple weeks ago, and the restaurant was closed because nobody showed up to work. It's just like an endless barrage, and people are stressed. And stress is not tension. Right? Stress is, I know I'm not where I'm supposed to be, and I don't know what to do about it. Tension, very different. It's, I know what good looks like. I also know where I am, and at least I have a pathway forward, right? And so the pathway is not finality, right? The pathway is a pathway. It's steps forward. It's incremental improvement. They might happen in some big leaps and some little leaps, but we know what good looks like, and we keep, you know, just try to get better with each step because we know what good looks like. And again, I like to call myself a recovering engineer. I have 3 engineering degrees. We like to, you know, there's a right answer, right? Numbers add up and all of those things. So the perfectionist at heart, struggles with this myself as one of my own hangups. But, you know, I don't know if I've ever seen the perfect problem solving. And I don't know if I've ever really seen the perfect solution, right? But what's better? What's better? Does it move me in the right direction? Does it move my problem solving effort in the right direction? Does it move the problem statement in the right direction? And then we take the next steps from there because we know what good looks like. We know what that good version looks like. And we just let that tension force us to, put some energy into improvement.
I like that. One of my mentors always told me is, Chris, it's really important that you like your ideas, but you can never fall in love with them. Because when you like them, you're open to people changing them and shaping them and challenging them. When you love them, you become defensive of them. You protect them. You get upset. You lose your emotional control when people challenge those. You go, so I just want you to like your ideas. I want you to love your work, but I want you to like your ideas. And I think that need for creative tension, what he was coaching me was be open to others' points of view to improve yours, or to at least change your point of view to help you learn more.
Yeah. And if you want to talk about, not falling in love with your own ideas, well, try publishing a book and then kind of go, well, it's out there now, right? it's hard to make it better without writing a second edition. But I think that's really good advice. It's love your work, right? So focus more on excellence in the process, right? And you'll get good outcomes with the solutions, right? But don't fall in love with a solution. Don't fall in love with your solution. Don't even fall in love with the idea that the solution has to come from you. There's organizations that I've worked with where we've tried to shift the culture from a borrowed idea quickly applied is more valuable than coming up with a new one, right? Because in these particular cases, the culture was we're gonna only use ideas that we've created, that we love, that we originated, and so like all these ideas would never get reused. They wouldn't scale across the organization. People would put tremendous energy into trying to come up with an original idea rather than something that simply solves the problem. And yeah, sometimes a copied solution is worth way more on a return on investment than an original one.
A good idea is always a good idea, right?
It's a good idea.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because when we talked about in the book, arriving at solutions, one of the challenges that you put to the reader was the need to focus on creativity over capital. I think sometimes with our problem solving, we get sucked into shiny bike syndrome or the new widget, the 2021 widget 2000 that will solve all of our problems. But in the book, you kind of challenge that a bit.
Yeah. And, you know, I love shiny objects too. I'm sitting here at a brand new desk that, replaces one from the 50s, I think, that moves up and down. And, you know, I have, you know, we all love shiny new objects, but, you know, first of all, capital, you know, spending money, it's really hard to unspend. And I've had clients that have done this. I've sat on boards of directors where we've been stuck with money that we spent. And it's like, well, why can't we just go back? Well, because nobody wants what we bought. You can't unspend, installing software in your organization. You can't, you know, some capital, hey, we built a new factory. Well, let's just sell it. Well, to who? For what? You don't get the money back. Secondly, everyone can spend the money, right? So you'd see this in industry. Certain industries would go on phases where they'd all spend money. So food processing for a while, like, doesn't matter what you're processing, but just food processing, there was a run where nobody was doing lean because there was faster baggers and palletizers and wrappers and there's just better equipment. So you just keep buying better equipment. But what makes you better? Well, they bought it too. You bought it. What's the difference? So you can't unspend it. Everyone else has access to spend the same capital. And fundamentally, there's only so many problems I can throw money at before I run out of it. Right? But creativity is one of those things that not only does it make us, you know, better in the moment, right? Because the return on investment, I solve the same problem, that's my return. My investment is lower, that's my investment. So my ROI is better almost every single time. But the part that I love about it is that the more you do that, the stronger you get at it. Right? And if you just make efforts at applying creativity and going past the obvious capital solutions or money intensive solutions or resource intensive solutions, work your way past that, try to find something creative. You may not always find it, but you get better at it. You get better at it over and over and over again because you're exercising those muscles. And creativity is one of those muscles that that atrophies if you don't use it. And you find a lot of people who have explored, you know, they had a creative interest, painting or music, or that they've refound in the pandemic. I actually picked up my old saxophone mostly because each of my kids have borrowed it at some point and played it.
Yeah, same guitar. Problem. Yeah,
we play guitar. I decided it was too much of a lift for me to really master it again. Relative to other things I have on my plate. But the point is you can't, it's not like riding a bike, right? Creativity requires us to use the muscles over and over again. The more we use them, the stronger we get. And that is something that other companies can't copy. And that's something that other individuals can't copy. They kind of have to build the muscle for themselves as well.
I creativity is contagious. I can remember in a previous role that I had was a fulfillment operation where we had, Jamie, when we had it, we thought it was top of the world, but we had this long conveyor line that then had a sharp 90-degree turn. And, you know, looking back on it, why do we have the 90-degree turn? Well, so we could fit more boxes on the line, right? And we would run the same orders that we had, regardless if it was a 40-piece order or a 2-piece order down that same line. And when we kind of broke the code internally, and it was one of the folks that did it every day, said, why do we have this big long line for a 2-piece order? Why can't we just go over there and set up some pallet locations and boxes on the floor and just drop them, hand band them and truck them over to where you need to be? It's like, yeah. And then everybody at that moment, they were looking for anywhere else in the facility where we could make another small line. So we went from, now we need conveyor. Well, we don't need that long conveyor anymore. Let's rip that up and turn that one long line into like 8 smaller ones where you just have a lot more velocity. And it was even the people coming over, hey, on these orders, I don't even know why we're you know, putting them in an overpack. It's still in a box. Let's just slap a sticker on it and send it on out. Well, can we do that? Go to the engineer. oh yeah, of course you can do that. I don't know why I didn't think of that earlier. Right. But it's that people don't appreciate that when you create an environment of innovation and everybody feels like they have an answer, that's when you really unlock the organization, because now everybody's involved in looking for a new solution, and you get a great little endorphin release when you solve a problem like that, and everybody gets to go home earlier, or they get more done in that day. They get a win out of the day.
Yeah, no, I think the endorphins are you know, a big kicker of the positive satisfaction of solving problems, as opposed to simply the relief of having been done with a problem, right? Those are two different reactions, and it is contagious. I mean, I have to say, the engineer in me again. You know, a recovering engineer. I don't really engineer anything anymore. But when I see a really creative engineering solution to a problem, even if it's in a product I bought or if it's at a client, I just get jazzed. I'm like, that's cool. I need that. Well, I don't really need that, but I just want to take a better look at how they did that, because that's really neat. And we all have different ways in which that happens. I mean, but creative solutions do inspire other creative solutions, and that's part of the human condition. That's part of what's allowed us to excel as a species, I guess. Not to get too deep and scientific on it.
Well, I mean, problem solving is adaptation in its purest sense. Like, if you want to get down to the core of the core here.
Yep.
We talked about it a little bit earlier, but on coaching. And coaching is very fundamentally different from leading or directing. It's got different roles, and even the coach becomes a learner at some point. They have to be a learner at some point. Can you talk about why coaching is so important in the problem solving?
So, I mean, I have a whole section on the book on coaching, and I have a section on the role of the leader, and I thought about just, you know, sort of, I don't say burying it, but including it in the role of the leader, because leaders should be coaches, right? But I just had a lot to say about it. The coaching can come from a lot of different places. It doesn't have to come from the coach or from the leader, and that's partly why it became its own section. But I think, you know, two reasons that it's so important. One is that this isn't like, you know, learning how to use, you know, virtual reality technology or learning how to do spreadsheets and, hey, I haven't done this before. How do I do this thing? Right. We are starting with a lifelong, whether we're 18 or 50, we're starting with a lifelong experience with solving problems. And that's a very personal thing. We start when we're infants. We start when we're toddlers, right? We start solving problems. We learn how to, I mean, learning how to crawl is fundamentally a problem solving. I need to get over to that side of the room, like that thing over there that's just out of reach, or that, you know, parent I want to get to. How do I get there? Let me try some stuff, right? Not a very, you know, I don't know if we would copy that and, you know, teach people how to problem solve that way, but we have been problem solving our entire lives. All of our good habits and all of our bad habits are a very personal learning journey, which means if I line up 10 people or 1,000 people, there's no norm, right? There's no, like, you know, center, there's no, you know, natural distribution. It's just everybody has unique hangups and unique blind spots, maybe not unique, but individualized perspectives, and again, bad things and good things. And so, you know, you don't want to move them to the norm. You actually want to leverage their strengths, right? But close the gaps on their weaknesses and their hangups and their blind spots, all of those things. And so it's really hard for training or recipes or tools or formulas to do that. You need a coach to kind of get a sense of where people struggle and what they're good at, and get the best out of them. The other reason is that I think, you know, problem solving is, you know, whether we're starting our coaching experience at 18 or 50, it's the journey ahead is also perpetual. And it's not like, yeah, I took a course, we solved two problems or 10 problems in the course, and now I'm better. Well, you might be, but the amount of progress you can make over the next 3 years is far greater. And the coach knows how to get the most out of that. So to me, the value of a coach in problem solving, in a lot of cases, coaching is a bigger investment than training. And as a result, I think has a greater impact than in training. So if you just line up all the different topics that we could get coached in or trained in, I think the ratio for problem solving is way askew towards coaching and problem solving relative to other topics.
Agreed. I also think that coaches will help identify when you are missing the fundamentals. And you talked about that in the book about coaching for behaviors, about if I get the right behaviors, I'll get the right outcomes. If I get the right principles lead to the right behaviors that lead to the right outcomes. And so those fundamentals matter, but coaches will point that out when there's a gap, but they won't say, hey, there's a gap. They'll ask you a question that says, well, Jamie, how do you think that ties back to the principle that we say that we hold dear on long-term thinking? Or how does this help with your, you lead others when it comes to simplification? So coaches rarely ever tell. They usually are equipped with the best questions.
Yeah. And so, first, I think with problem solving, because it's stuff that happens inside of us, right? It's our brains and our hearts and our energy that we bring to the table. We can't just follow a recipe. And that means we bring our knowledge to the table. And I think earned knowledge is far more valuable, far more sustainable, and also far more flexible to be built upon in the future than simply adopted knowledge, right? And so a coach, by asking questions, allows someone, well, not just allows them, drives, shapes, encourages someone to earn their knowledge. And also, of course, allows them to earn their knowledge. And then there's so much more to work with once you've earned your knowledge. And questions are a powerful tool, but it's the right kinds of questions. And I distinguish between, so sometimes people ask questions, but it's really advocacy disguised as questions. Yeah. Like, isn't it true that, I mean, lawyers do this all the time.
Objection, leading the witness. Right.
Yeah, exactly. That's what you're doing. You're basically advocating a point. You just framed it as a question so that you can say you ask questions. I'm a leader who asks questions all the time. Isn't it true that you're an idiot? Like, so it's not what we really meant to say, right? So I look at both guiding questions and reflection questions. Guiding questions are things that allow people to think through what they have to do, but they still own the plan, right? They still own the process of going forward, but you're helping them go forward purposefully and thoughtfully. Reflection questions is what happens after that. And it helps them look back at what they experienced and extracts and squeezes the knowledge and the lessons out of that stuff. And so, there's asking the right questions, which makes a whole lot of difference. That is a teachable skill for coaches.
Well, Jamie, in your book, you talk about the pursuit of knowledge. So on a personal level, what was the most important lesson that you learned for yourself in writing this book?
So I think a couple of things. One is I'll just say that a lot of the nuggets that come out of this book are things that, I'd find little micro lessons for that I just hadn't thought about as sharply as I did. And I'll give an example about that. I wrote a section called the around the role of the leader being the architect of their system. And, I've helped design operating systems and, you have lean daily management and all these systems that you deploy out in your organization. I don't mean computer systems, that too, but like, here's how we work, right? This is our operating system, our management system, our way of working. But all context is local. And I don't care if you run a team of 10 people, the nature of that team, its composition, the mode that it's in, crisis or stable, you know, how it operates, there's so much context that you still have to be an architect of your own localized system. So, you know, that's just an example of a nugget, right? But that nugget wasn't that clear to me, or in how much of your system does have to be contextualized for your local environment, and that every leader has to be their own architect at that level. That was, I probably said things like that before, but nowhere near as clear in my mind about how true that point is and how it shows up. I think the bigger lesson for me of the pursuit of knowledge was really, you know, I'll say the first version of this book still was peppered with my favorite tools, right? My favorite tools. And I have my favorite tools, and there's reasons I have my favorite tools, and a lot of it's my experience. But some of the people that I've worked with use different tools than I do, and they're damn good. They're damn good at what they do. And so the second version, you know, I made the book really tool agnostic, and I still have my favorite tools. And if somebody said, hey, teach me problem solving tools, I'd be like, all right, here we go. Here's what I like to use. And I'm not going to let go of that because that's what works for me. And that's how I know how to teach. But when I wrote the second version of this book that really became tool agnostic, the book got better, not worse, by me really trying to strip the tools out of it entirely and make it about everything but the tools. And I have a chapter that basically says, you know, the tools do matter. Yeah. They do matter.
And you list them out. Yeah.
And I list them and I explore a little, you know, please don't tell me all the tools I missed. Not you, but the listeners and the readers. Yeah. You know, I'm sure I know I missed plenty, some on purpose, but by stripping the tools out of the book, I made the book better, which really proved to me how much the tools are not just an inventory. They are their own personal journey, right, that people go on, and their experience and their exploration of the tools. And so, you know, my favorite tools are based on my experience, not based on a truly objective view of what's better, right? Because again, there's people out there who use different tools that are really good problem solvers that I would be glad to collaborate with. And so I think even the tools are a personal journey. We still need them, but again, I think I care less than I did before I wrote the book about what particular tools people decide to pick up.
Awesome. Jamie, how can people get a copy of the book if they're interested?
Well, I mean, on Amazon or any of their favorite booksellers, if they're listening to this, the day it comes out, it will still be on a pre-order sale. It's launching October 26th, 2021. We'll have, you know, hardcover, paperback, ebook, as well as an audiobook. I don't know if that'll launch on that date, but it's done. It's being uploaded. Hopefully will also be available that day. So your preference, it should be available at most booksellers. But if you're ever not sure, you can go to jflinch.com, my website, and we'll have a page linking to all the places able to buy the book from.
All right. Well, Jamie, I'll make sure to put links in the show note page for how to get to the book, how to get to Jay Flinch, how to get to in touch with you from we have that from in the past in your episode 2. Thank you for coming today and talking to us about the book. The book is People Solve Problems, The Power of Every Person, Every Day, Every Problem. The author is Jamie Flinchbaugh. Jamie, thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much. Be well.
I want to thank Jamie for being a guest on the podcast today. Be sure to go to the show notes page at leanleadershippodcast.com. Check out the links and how to connect with Jamie if you have a question about what we talked about today. As always, I welcome your feedback on how to improve the podcast. If you like the podcast, make sure you go to podchaser.com/leanleadershippodcast and leave a rating for the podcast and also a review. Thank you for listening. And until next time, seek progress over perfection.
Thanks for listening to the Lean Leadership Podcast with Chris Burnham. Get more info, resources, tools, or connect at leanleadershippodcast.com.